Vitamin C has evolved. Altrient Vitamin C is a cutting-edge liposomal liquid food supplement designed for maximized absorption. Discover Altrient Liposomal Vitamin C and receive 10% discount by quoting HR10 at abundanceandhealth.com.
Hello and thank you so much for joining me on the show today. This is The Diabetes Show on UK Health Radio, your global, real, feel-good radio station. My name is Peter Alton of Undefeated and I'm your host for today and the coming weeks. Hello and welcome once again to the Diabetes Show here on UK Health Radio. Hope you have had an amazing week. It's been a somewhat traumatic one for me with some incredible amount of pain that I had in my back and in my knee. And that's quite appropriate really, particularly the knee pain, because we are going to be talking to someone today about pain management. It's a GP by the name of Alistair Dixon, and he's an amazing guy. I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with him, and I think you also will find what he has to say interesting and hopefully of benefit. The interview is going to be spread out over the next 2 weeks, so you'll have half of it this week and the next half the following week. I hope you enjoy it. We're going to kick off, before we get into that interview, with a song which Alistair chose. I always think it's important that we allow our guests to share a little bit of their taste of music. And we're going to kick off with the Rolling Stones and Painted Black. Hope you enjoy it.
Dressed in their summer clothes, I have to turn my head and tell my darling. So that was the Rolling Stones and Painted a Black. And that was chosen by our guest today. You're listening to The Diabetes Show here on UK Health Radio. And our guest today is Dr. Alistair Dixon. Welcome to the show, Alistair.
Hi, many thanks for inviting me, Peter.
It's great to have you here. And you chose that song, so please reveal all. Why was it your choice for today's show?
Well, apart from liking the Rolling Stones, I think it sums up quite a lot about depression and what causes depression. And one of the biggest causes I come across is pain.
Right.
And I think it also highlights that, you know, grief and depression can often be caused by loss of somebody, but it can also be by loss of something in your life. And that doesn't have to be a person or an animal. It can actually be activities that you like doing. And pain is a big issue with that.
And we're all aware of loss of activities and things that we want to do at the moment, of course, with the pandemic. So pain or no pain, there's a lot of depression and stuff going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. It makes you realise that people who are already struggling have found it much, much harder in this pandemic. And so we are expecting and are already starting to see increased rates of muscular and rheumatological conditions, including back pain and the related mental health aspects.
Mm. Okay, so I introduced you as doctor, but of course that could have been a PhD or all sorts. and you obviously have given the listeners a hint that you're actually a medical doctor. I believe you had quite a convoluted route into medicine. Please, can you just share with us a little bit about how you got to where you are now and, maybe how previous lives have influenced you?
Yeah, well, I'd always wanted to do medicine and I'd not been considered bright enough in that I didn't get the grades by a long way. So I ended up doing maths and economics and discovered that I quite liked the economics and I somehow managed to pass some of the maths courses. And so I came out with a degree from that and then not well enough to do medicine. So I ended up doing health economics and at York University and discovered that its focus on outcomes of what, not disease, not treating that disease course, but actually what does a patient need, what's relevant to the patient, was really interesting. And I enjoyed doing it. And I felt that actually I was able to make a bigger input. So I did that for a little while and ended up doing health policy in Parliament, where you saw the global aspects and how decisions were made. And then I ended up being ill myself. So I saw life from being a patient. And that changed my view on life again. And I decided to try once more for medicine and was very fortunate to get in to Durham University and started medicine in Stockton and then moved up to Newcastle University after we'd done the preclinical course. So after all that, I combined everything and I found that aspect of coming from health economics, where you've seen it from different perspectives, including industry and from policy decision, but more importantly, you were thinking about quality of life as well as life expectancy. And you asked why more, and you asked, how is this going to make a difference to patients? And that caused chaos when you were at medical school because
you're asking too many questions.
Yeah, well, A, they didn't like questions. B, they weren't used to someone saying, but is this relevant? You know, why in things like chemotherapy, are we making a difference to the patient or that they want? And sometimes you were and sometimes you weren't. And that continues in all aspects of medicine. And it hopefully makes me more willing to ask the patient what they want and try and elicit sort of their concerns, their ideas, their expectations, and try and come up with a treatment plan that works better for them.
Now, you're a GP, aren't you?
I am a GP, yeah.
Go on, sorry, you're going to say something else? But I think I heard.
I'm a GP. I work in York and the North Yorkshire area, and have an interest in musculoskeletal and rheumatological areas of medicine.
You know, you've just dashed a load of the hopes of listeners. They were always had their ears pricked up to you earlier on, thinking, this sounds like a doctor I want as my GP. And then you say, I'm in the York, and all the people in York are going, yes, this. Because certainly myself, I mean, I spoke with you last week. We spent quite a long time actually just chatting, getting to know each other as a sort of preamble before this. And I really appreciate your time and your energy you're putting into this interview, both today and then as well. And something that really did come across to me was just how you're not your run-of-the-mill, stuck in your ways type of GP like some are, not all, of course. You're very forward-thinking, very open to different things, different new and some older ideas around patient treatment and outcomes. So it's great to have you on here. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about something I think the listeners can definitely relate to, and you've just mentioned that you're sort of into MSK, which is musculoskeletal, for those people which are not sure what we're talking about. Many people, either themselves or a loved one in their family, suffers from pain and particularly arthritic pain as well. And that's really what we're looking at today, I suppose, joint pain more than anything else. Can you just tell the listeners what actually is going on in a person? I know there's different types, but generally speaking, what's going on in the joints of someone who may be suffering from arthritis? You can pick on one type if you want, or just talk generally, whichever.
That's a big question. First of all, thank you for your kind words. I think if we look at pain, we know that different people get pain in different ways, or they perceive it and they experience it in different ways. And we're not really sure quite why. We have some ideas, but you'd probably win the Nobel Prize if you could give the definitive answer for each person. So we know that people who are hyperflexible, so hypermobile, experience more pain than other people. And we believe that that's because some of their proprioceptor receptors, which are the aspects of the joint which allow you to identify where your limb or part of your limb is in space in relation to your body, don't work in the same way as people who are not hypermobile. And in effect, they are more like pain receptors, which they are the specialized versions of. And so we are aware that those people will get more pain, come what may, than other people in general, even if we give them the same or more painkillers, i.e. painkillers don't work as well.
Right.
What does work better with them appears to be keeping fit and physiotherapy type exercises. And we think that that's because it actually improves those proprioceptors back to thinking about proprioception rather than pain. So you have a genetic aspect in some people, and in some other people you have the opposite, who just don't feel pain. In between, you've got the majority of the population. And if we break pain down in the joints to muscular or sort of mechanical aspect, which some people call wear and tear, and which we typically call osteoarthritis, and inflammatory aspects, which includes rheumatoid and gout, which is the commonest form of inflammatory arthritis in the UK, then we've got osteoarthritis, which is typically considered non-inflammatory, and then inflammatory. Now, just to complicate matters, osteoarthritis can be non-inflammatory, and now we've realized some of it is inflammatory. So if you're not confused yet, then you're probably beating most of us healthcare professionals who try and work it out in our brain and then have to try and work out what you have as a patient. But osteoarthritis, which is what most people have, and you tend to get it as you get older. So most people start saying, I've got this or I've got that, and a bad knee, a bad hip, painful hands, painful neck, which is the third commonest osteoarthritic joint in the body.
Okay.
All of that tends to start happening when you're 40 and above. But we know that this has gone on forever and a day. So we can pull out CT scans of that we've done of Neolithic bodies in an 18 or 20-year-old man and find that they have osteoarthritis OA changes. So why does it cause pain if it's happening from that age, and why doesn't it happen until you're 40 in most people? Well, again, we're not quite sure, but what we think is that osteoarthritis is actually a natural healing repair process of the joints. And it probably has non-inflammatory and inflammatory aspects. And therefore, it's all related in part to your immune system. And more recent research has shown that your immune system and your mental health are closely related. So if you are low in mood, you're going to have more pain because it affects your immune system if everything else is equal. And if you're happy, you probably have a bit less pain. So going back to the pandemic, do we expect that pain in joint pain is going to increase? Yes. And there's probably an aspect of what I've just explained as a cause for that. So some of us have been predicting that this would be an issue. If we look at osteoarthritis, we've got drugs which work on inflammation, such as typically the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which by their name tells you that they're working on the inflammatory aspect of the immune system. And we think that that helps with some of the pain. And typically that could be the cartilage in your knees and your hips. And then we've also got physios who make a big difference, and particularly in backs. So low back pain, we know the majority of that is actually to do with physiotherapy and actually increasingly cognitive behavioral therapy, where we explore people's ideas, perceptions, understanding of pain. And we explain as per sort of the evidence base, and we can see that in the NICE guidelines on back pain, that actually most of the time, keeping fit, keeping going, will sort you back. And that actually the pain is not as important as when you get pain as a child, when it tells you that something's wrong and you must stop. We actually educate people how to manage their pain. Now, that's still controversial, but it's based on evidence. And part one of my roles is as GP clinical lead for the North of England low back pain team. And a lot of the work we did led on to the NICE low back pain guidelines. So going back to osteoarthritis, if you think about hips and knees, which we know we can do joint replacements for, is osteoarthritis a damaging disease, or is it actually a normal progressive repair of the body? We think it's progressive repair, but we know that a sedentary Western lifestyle, coupled probably with obesity, makes things worse. So it probably, and I emphasize probably, means that how you live your life and the activities you do will impact on how that bone regenerates.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with the cartilage. Because what we're doing is we've got an immune system that's saying, I need to replace this bit of the body on a regular basis. And it tries to replace it in the right way. So it tries to do that in a normal manner. But if you are more active, it may have a different way of replacing to those who are less active, and the same if you're overweight or clinically obese compared to if you're normal weight. So lots of questions, but that's when you listen to some of the experts in the field. These are the sorts of theories that they're coming out with, and understanding some of that can help us when we talk to patients who are struggling with pain and come up with ideas of how best we can move forward. Because it's not always a joint replacement that is the first thing we should do. A, because it's not appropriate. And B, because sometimes it's better to keep your body going. Often better to keep your body going, especially if you're young.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think your answer there, very thorough answer, just sort of shows how you've got to think about the whole person as well. It's not just that joint or those joints. It's, like you say, the mental health of that particular person, obesity, etc. I've got this feeling there's probably going to be some listeners thinking, you know what, I get a bit of hip pain, I get a bit of knee pain, I've not seen anyone yet. What's your opinion? I mean, let's say we've got this lady, Martine, who's listening at the moment, and she's thinking, my hip does pain up if I go for a walk and my knee. Now, I know what I would say to them if they came into me. But if somebody came into your surgery just on one side, one knee, one hip, aching away, bit stiff maybe in the morning, impact, bit of pain there, what would she expect to experience at a consult with you? I know it's a bit of a big question with many facets to it.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you said when she comes into my room, and a year ago we would have all said yes. But these days, increasingly, it's a virtual conversation. Telephone, if you're lucky, on the screen. A year ago, I would go and collect all my patients from, meet and greet them in the waiting room. And you get a phenomenal amount of information from observing them sitting there, getting up, how they walk, not just when they get into your consulting room.
Yeah.
So assuming that we'd done that, I would be seeing perhaps that she's limping or that she isn't limping. Both are useful. If she is limping, then she's probably still got pain at the moment. So it's maybe more common than if she was a stoical sort of North Yorkshire farmer's wife, she would normally let on. Alternatively, if she's not limping, I'd be thinking, well, when does it give you the pain even more? When she starts the story. If she's walking with a stick, then I know it's more chronic. She's not walking with a stick, it's probably not chronic. I'll have already assessed sort of the way she stands, her musculature, how much muscle she got, particularly on your backside, because if you are getting to the stage of severe hip arthritis, you often start getting wasting of that side where the affected hip is on the buttock. So it's one way of being able to ascertain very quickly during examination, but also just as a spot check, is there a problem going on here that's chronic? But the first thing is to listen to the patient. So now then, what's the problem? If it's just started, maybe she'd been running and she'd been running over some uneven ground and twisted it, or had been knocked when she'd got out of the bath or opened or closed the car door on it. Then you've got different views of what's going on. It just happened 2 or 3 days ago. Pain tends to get worse for the first 3 days of an acute injury, and then it starts to subside. Has there been any sort of irritation of that knee? You know, does it hurt down the side of it? So has she irritated her ligaments and sprained them? In which case, we're looking at slightly longer, and we might be thinking about physiotherapy, but we're also thinking about painkillers in all cases. Of this acute thing. And the reason for that is not to kill the pain and get rid of it, but it's actually to manage the pain so that it allows your body to actually start moving more normally, which essentially allows you to recover faster. And I always say to patients, I'm not trying to cure the pain. I'm trying to manage the pain and help you manage it. If it's a long-term thing, so she's been struggling for a while and it's there most days, where is it? Is it when she goes up and down stairs and hills, particularly when they come down? So, which is perverse. If you'd asked me when I was training, do you think someone will get anterior knee pain when they're coming down the stairs more than when they're going up the stairs? I'd have said, no, I think it's the other way around, because surely you need more muscle and strength to go up. Actually, you need more muscle strength to control coming down a hill or down a stair. So that's why you often get that anterior knee pain starting when you're going down a hill or downstairs, and then it starts to develop more frequently. Has the person stopped doing exercise? And if so, when? I often will say, when did you stop riding your bike or doing as much exercise? Was it 12 to 18 months ago? And it's normally about that time, which is about the rough time that, particularly 18 months, that your muscle strength deteriorates over. So essentially you've become unfit. So again, if it's taken that length of time to get there, it's going to take a while to get back, hopefully not 18 months. But then I'm going to be looking at using physios or printed exercise sheets and explanations to say, these are the core muscles we need to develop. That's assuming that we've just thinking about the hip and knee. The other bit is, you said one-sided. So one-sided tells me it's wear and tear, osteoarthritis. Both sides tells me it's a systemic and over the body, over all the body aspect. So it's likely to be both sides. So rheumatoid is probably going to be bilateral, both sides. So one-sided, going back to your case study. I'm also thinking though, and this is a foot show. So what's going on? Is it definitely just that joint? So you should always be thinking, if someone's complaining about the knee joint, say, what about the joint above and the joint below? Which is where we start to get into your territory. So I'm going to knock it back, because I want to learn from you, hopefully as much as the listeners do. What do you look for?
They're fed up with hearing it from me. I was impressed last week when we spoke about how you were very on the ball with what podiatrists can do, and it was a real pleasure to hear. I think I actually shared with you about the time I actually managed to be on TV. I was asked to go on the Alan Titchmarsh show, and at the end of it, the resident GP on there, Alan said, any last comments to her? And she goes, yes. And this is after I've gone on about foot problems for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes or so. And she said, so if you've got a problem with your feet, go and see a GP. And you can see on screen my face sort of like, sort of a perplexed, angry look on my face. Anyway, I appreciate the fact that you're definitely not like that. Finding it back to me, I mean, the listeners have definitely heard me talking about this before, but I think part of the problem is that we aren't walking around as God intended anyway. We're not running around, forest floors and caves and our feet doing all sorts of things, all those internal little muscles working. We're shoving them in shoes, flat, hard surfaces, pretty unforgiving surfaces all day long, pretty much the feet doing the same thing repeatedly rather than those muscles working. Not that I'm saying we should all walk around barefoot, because, well, we'd still be on flat, hard surfaces and there still wouldn't be much adaptation in the way the foot's working. So in my experience, we find that actually by altering the way the foot works in some people can really make a big difference to the forces going up the foot. And one of the little gadgets I have when we're doing an assessment, and more so afterwards actually, is a little device that sits on the lower back. And people sometimes think, well, why are you putting this on my back? And the whole point is, well, look, if you stand in front of a mirror and you let your arches drop, you'll see your knees rotated inwards. You won't see your pelvis rotating forwards, but it will be. And that's normal. But if your foot isn't actually behaving normally, then your knee won't behave normally. Your hip won't behave normally. It may be doing it too quickly. It may be doing it too much. It may be doing it at the wrong time in the gait cycle. That's a classic one where somebody's pushing off on their foot in the wrong position, so the knee's in the wrong position. You asked me, I'm carrying on. Listeners can't see you putting your hand up to stop me. I'll stop. Over to you, Alistair.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely what you're saying. So when I'm looking at the patient, I'm thinking about that. So I've already observed the gait. If they've done a lot of horse riding and they're 70 or 80, and they've worn out their hips, sometimes they actually get that sort of cowboy swagger, exaggerated John Wayne sort of. It's ancient now, isn't it? I mean, well, he's dead, but the films are ancient now. But, you know, 20 years ago, people would probably still be watching some of the John Waynes, and you'd see this sort of lopsided gait as people are walking. So that's starting to tell you things. But I'll often examine their back, and I'll certainly be looking at their iliac crests, which when you put your hands round your waist at the back where your belt goes, you'll find two pieces of semicircular bone on the right and the left side. And they should be essentially even. And it's amazing how many people don't have that. So they'll come in complaining about this pain, but when you take a fuller history, it's got back pain, neck pain when it's really bad, shoulder pain, and so on and so forth. And just feeling that, you can tell that if they're out of sync, then probably the oblique muscle or another muscle is in tension. So I'll do a more of an examination. And a little bit of quality sports massage can actually reduce that and relieve that. But I'm also thinking about, well, why? So I don't have your gadget, and I'm not trained enough. I was going to say clever enough, which is probably also the truth. But what I will do is I'll roll up their trousers and I'll look at the calves. Have I got wasting of one of the calves? Have I got wasting of the thigh muscles? That tells me which leg's affected. So I'll always say, right, if we're going to build this up, you need to build it up so it's bigger than the other side. So if your thigh muscle is an inch smaller than your other legs, then that's significant. And I want it to be bigger than the, build it up so it's bigger. And that seems to solve some of the problems. The same with the calf aspect. And then I'm starting to think about my Achilles tendons in certain parts. But I'm also looking at where things are rolled in and out. And I might get them to walk up and down the room. But a really easy way, before I've done any of that, is say, can I have a look at your shoes?
Yeah.
And they look at you. Why are you doing that? So you should have even wear on your soles of your shoes. And if you're lucky, they've come in with their shoes that they've worn for a bit, not the ones that they bought yesterday or their new ones or their best ones because they come to see the doctor. And you look at them and you think, it's wearing hard on this bit. And that's when I start to think, right, have I got a functional and mechanical aspect here that I need to send to a podiatrist for that aspect? So that's one of my real simple tricks. And you can do it yourself at home. If you think, right, I've got pain down in my lower limb, particularly say if you've got sort of a foot arch pain or you've got ankle pain or knee pain, have a look at your shoes. And is there sort of abnormal wearing? And by that, I'm meaning, is it equal? And if it's not equal on both shoes, does it, what does it look like? And is it, what does the sole look like? Have you got an area which is really heavily being worn out? So you get this often with runners. I don't know what you find, but I often pick it up with runners probably 10, 20 years before they develop, if they didn't run. And they come in, and particularly in the summer, or if it's winter and they've been training on the roads because it's too boggy to go across the ground. Summer, it's because it's the, you know, they're off cross country as they're meant to do, but the ground's got too hard. And they're coming complaining of things. So then I don't always send to a podiatrist, sir. I might send them to a running shop. Even if they're...
Yeah, sometimes that's...
Sorry. Even if they're 70, I might say, will you go and see if you can use their walking machine just to get an idea of what's going on? And often the running shops are really, really useful and really helpful. But I don't know, what do you do? Because this is where I can learn.
I think we had a podiatrist working for us, and he used to sometimes take people up to the running shop to help them to choose appropriate trainers for them for just for walking, even if it's some elderly people. I think the level of analysis there is more focused on the running and the pronation that's going on there, how much the pronation is going on, rather than the timing of it. And with walking, that's something which we often pick up on what hasn't been picked up on, amongst other things, when a person has been to, let's say, on a treadmill or something, have an analysis at a running shop. because one of the key things that we see it creates a lot of problems is this late pronation taking place. So pronation, the collapsing of the arch for the listener's benefit there, it happens for two real reasons. One is to shock absorb as you hit the ground, and the other one is to adapt, foot can adapt to this uneven ground we're supposed to be walking around on. And if the foot is still in that adaptable position when you're pushing off on it, then you're pushing off on a loose bag of bones instead of a strong arch that should be levering you forwards. So that's an angle where we really, really find it helpful to assess and then to intervene. And we would normally intervene, maybe exercises, quite likely some sort of foot orthosis, some sort of insole to help. But you prompted me to start talking on this stuff, but we're going a little bit away from what I think you were going to talk about more than me. So let's just go back into that a little bit, because I asked about the Martine coming in to see you, and you talked about some of the things that might happen, some frontline treatments from what I've heard. And I suppose we should maybe just touch on, well, there were some guidelines by NICE last year, weren't there, last summer, condemning the use of long-term analgesics for people. I don't think it's been sort of, I think it was just some proposed guidelines rather than actual guidelines. I'm not sure. Historically, analgesics would be the way forward alongside some of the other things that we've talked about. What's the score there? What's your view on analgesics and what NICE are saying? And yeah, over to you.
So these are the draft NICE guidelines on use of painkillers, particularly opiates, but many other painkillers for what is traditionally called.
Yeah, this is what you mean by opiates? Sorry.
Absolutely. So. Okay. Chronic pain is now known as persistent pain. So it's pain that's gone on and keeps coming back for more than 3 months. And increasingly, the evidence has been starting to show quite forcefully in some cases that we are overusing painkillers. Now, opiates are basically morphine-related medications. So they contain morphine. And there is evidence in this country that us as clinicians, when we prescribe opiate medications, so those containing morphine, which is the medication that is legal to prescribe, illicit equivalent medication is what we classify as heroin on the street or similar. So that is why you've got all these aspects of concern, because we all know that we don't want to be addicted to these things, but as clinicians we have at times not thought about what we're doing, and we have at times inadvertently got people more dependent or completely dependent on opiate-based medications. And in some cases that's led to some people then buying it off the street because they're that addicted. And this can be a big problem. And I've treated many patients with this who have developed it through prescribing, as well as those who have not received their addiction through prescribed drugs. And that's one of the reasons I've treated these patients, is because I've got my first part of the certificate for treating such patients. And it is very difficult for these patients, once they're on it, for you to actually reduce, because your pain appears to become dependent on how much opiates your body's used to. And as the opiate level in your body goes down, then your pain goes back up. So you have to, what we say, titrate, which is reduce the opiate dose slowly but surely. So this is a worldwide concern. And interestingly, a study in Denmark has shown, I believe it's Denmark, has shown that the level of pain in their community, in their patients, after, I think it's childbirth, but I can't remember the study completely, where they don't use as half as much, if not really any opiates compared to what we have in the UK, they have less pain than we do in the UK.
Hmm.
So what's going on?
I was about to say, what's going on there?
And we don't, again, there's more questions than answers, but essentially what NICE have done is they've gone through the evidence and they've raised these really tricky questions. And you can hear in what I've just said how cautiously I'm stumbling in my words, but trying very cautiously not to say the wrong thing, not to upset people, and stick to the evidence. But the evidence that NICE in these draft guidelines have stated is that not just with opiates, but with many other drugs as well, we are using them too much and too frequently. I first came across this from an evidence-based perspective when we were looking at low back pain, and we started having to realize that actually we're using too many opiates and too many other drugs. And that's why the NICE low back pain and radiculopathy guidelines that were published 2 or 3 years ago now say you should use paracetamol and a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory such as ibuprofen. And if you're not able to take ibuprofen, you need something more than paracetamol, cocodamol, which is codeine, which is an opiate, plus paracetamol combined as one pill. And we said you shouldn't be using anything else for pain. We also, now as we look at the evidence, and this is what NICE was also starting to say, realize that we should be maybe using painkillers in short bursts, almost as a pain relief holiday, rather than using painkillers all the time.
And this is even things like paracetamol and non-steroidals, yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, all of what I'm saying will be controversial to some people. And that is not just patients and the general public, but also within the healthcare profession. And this is really where NICE sort of appears to have had a lot of backlash. So the NICE draft guidelines at the moment have not been formalized as final guidelines. And I believe that at the moment, the next date for potential publication of the final guidance is April. It's, in my understanding, has been delayed at least twice from the emails I've received. So, and I'm not involved in the committee that's been doing these guidelines. But it is controversial. But NICE works on the evidence. So they go through the evidence, they look at the evidence, they are trying to, again, it comes back to outcomes. It's not necessarily treating the disease. If we're treating the disease, we say pain is caused by this. And if we target this aspect of the body where the pain's caused or is recepted, then if we knock those receptors out, then we can get rid of the pain. Now, maybe that's where we have gone wrong as a profession in some ways, by over-focusing on that. Because if you're not thinking about the outcomes, then you're maybe missing the point. And ultimately, what we're starting to see is that actually you increase and increase and increase the amount of painkillers you give, and it doesn't necessarily, at the end of the day, in X number of years' time, the patient's still got significant pain, despite the fact that we've increased and gone up stronger and stronger painkillers. So are we actually treating the problem, or are we thinking we're treating the problem but not actually doing it? And all the medications I prescribe and my colleagues prescribe, essentially, we're using them for their side effects, because most of the things that we use to treat have toxic effects. So someone once said to me, think of them as what you're prescribing is essentially a poison that you're using at therapeutic doses for their side effects. What you're not wanting to do is cause harm. But everything you prescribe has the potential to cause harm.
Yeah.
The problem with health economics is that we don't include harm easily in economic module assessment. So you've always got to think about what harm am I doing? And my first priority as a doctor and as any healthcare professional is to my patient and the safety of my patient. And sometimes it means that you have to have the discussion with whoever you're seeing, say, I hear where you're coming from, but I don't think I can prescribe today because I can't. I'm concerned from a clinical risk decision that I do more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that you need to go and ask for more advice. You might need to seek more information. And sometimes it may just be, no, that is not clinically appropriate. And that is a horrendously difficult conversation to have. Because quite understandably, people can be upset. So going back to your point at hand and having sort of gone into depth about the NICE thing, what does this mean for my patients? And what does it mean for where I'm treating joint pain going forward? Well, it's made me and many of my colleagues more circumspect about what we're doing and how we're doing, and made us think about painkillers. And this is not, the opioid crisis is not the first thing that has flared in the musculoskeletal medicine environment with risks to painkillers or from painkillers. We also had the Vioxx concerns about a decade ago, where this was a clever non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug called a COX-2, which targets a specific part of the pain receptors and pain pathway. So it's like an ibuprofen, but it was designed to hopefully cause less side effects to stomach irritation. And unfortunately, that drug appeared fine initially and was allowed to be used, but on further inspection and as cases of side effects rose, we realized that there were more serious issues, and I believe they were cardiovascular issues. And I know it was cardiovascular, but I'm not going to go into too much depth there. That caused all sorts of concerns, and eventually Vioxx was removed from the market. But it's made us much more aware that there are pros and cons with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And more recently, paracetamol has also been identified as causing gastric irritation in some patients. So it goes back to that point. Everything we prescribe is likely to have a side effect, multiple side effects. And the person who turns around and tells you that there is no side effect from anything that they from a drug that they're prescribing you, even if the literature shows that, it's probably just not quite true, and it's probably that we just haven't found the side effect yet.
And on that note, I'm afraid I'm going to have to call it a day and interrupt the interview, because we got so much content that we've split it over the 2 weeks. So next week we will have Alistair back on, and he'll be sharing then about a particular natural product which can really help replace some of the painkillers for some people with their joint pain. So if you've got joint pain, or perhaps you are particularly concerned about getting it later in life, then let me suggest that you tune in next week and hear what Alistair has to say. Thank you, Alistair, for your time, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. If you've got any questions at all, then please do get in touch with me. You can do that via contact@undefeated.org, contact@undefeated.org, and I'd be more than happy to pass on any questions you've got to Alistair. So until we see you next week, have a wonderful time and a safe time. Take good care. And that is it for this week's show. You've been listening to Peter Alton with The Diabetes Show here on UK Health Radio, your global, real, feel-good radio station. All that remains is for me to say have a fantastic week. Stay safe in the diabetes sweet spot. Living the ideal diabetic lifestyle. I look forward to sharing more with you next week. Take good care and God bless.